Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a hot night in July 1995, Janet Downing, a 42-year-old mother of four, was brutally stabbed 98 times in her home in Somerville, a city 2 miles northwest of Boston. Within hours, a suspect was identified, 15-year-old Eddie O'Brien, the best friend of one of Janet's sons. But why Eddie? He had no prior history of criminal behavior. He was not mentally ill. He had neither motive nor opportunity to commit the crime. Yet none of that mattered because powers beyond his Somerville neighborhood decided that Eddie needed to be guilty. The timing of this case did not bode well for Eddie. A movement hoping to stop the supposed rise of young super predators was sweeping the nation, and juvenile offenders were the targets. Both the Massachusetts governor and an elected district attorney who personally litigated this case supported juvenile justice reform, and both aspired to higher offices. Eddie O'Brien's case garnered both local and national publicity. He was a youthful Irish Catholic boy next door. His grandfather was the retired chief of the Somerville Police Department. Court TV covered the trial in adult court gavel to gavel, calling it the altar boy murder case. His highly publicized case changed the juvenile laws in Massachusetts. Other states began to follow suit. But did the justice system fail Eddie? That's the contention of author attorney Margot Nash in her explosive expose, The Politics of Murder. Appointed Eddie's guardian ad litem, Nash attended every court session and eventually gained access to all his files. Now, after painstaking research and examination of each step of the investigation, trial transcripts, and the forensic evidence, Nash makes the case that Eddie could not have committed the crime and that other viable suspects were never properly considered. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Politics of Murder, with my special guest journalist and author and attorney, Margot Nash. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Margot Nash.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much. Fascinating case. Again, as I mentioned before, I'm learning so much for the vast differences between state law. Incredible difference.
Yes.
Let's get right to this. I won't ask why you got involved with this because we will see very early on why you were involved with this. As I mentioned, you were appointed the guardian ad litem. Let's just start with what a guardian ad litem is. Give us that background and give us your background as a lawyer before, as an introduction to how you came to this case.
Sure. A guardian ad litem is an attorney, usually an attorney, it doesn't have to be, appointed in a lawsuit, and generally it happens in child custody proceedings, and they are appointed to protect the interests of the child, who is a minor. And in this particular case, Eddie's attorneys asked for the appointment of a guardian ad litem for various reasons, the judge appointed me to help Eddie navigate his way through the system. He was in the juvenile system at that particular point to help him understand the proceedings and various things that were happening to him. My background is that I graduated from law school in 1983, and for 5 years I was an attorney with the State Department of Social Services, where I prosecuted child abuse and neglect cases. And I then went into private practice and did a number of different areas of law, one of which was juvenile law, another was divorce and child custody. And I also was certified by the court after taking certain courses, required courses, to be a guardian ad litem, to act as a guardian ad litem, so that I could protect children's rights in the court system.
Now, as you talk about in the book here, you set up the story, begin the story with a little background on Eddie O'Brien. His grandfather's birthday was a week before this incident. His grandfather,
correct,
TJ, or Chief, as he was known, was the chief of police for the Somerville Police, as we had mentioned, and he had retired years before. Eddie's father's name was Ed. So tell us a little bit about who Eddie's family was, the members of his family, and tell us about the Downing family, which was right across the street, before we talk about this little neighborhood a little ways out of Boston.
Okay. Eddie's parents, their names are Ed and Patricia, and Patricia was, her maiden name is also O'Brien. They both grew up in Somerville. They both come from Irish Catholic families with several siblings. Ed Sr. is the youngest of his group of siblings, having been born much after some of his older siblings. He grew up in the house that Eddie and his siblings later grew up in. It was a family home owned by the chief. There were five children in the house. Eddie had an older sister named Jean. Eddie, Jessica was 12 at the time, two little girls named Mary and Megan, 3 years old and 3 months old at the time of the incident. So that's who was living in the Eddie O'Brien house. And Papa, the grandfather, the chief, was in the house. As you said, there was a birthday party for him the week before this incident. He had just been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was not well. And he would die not too long after Eddie's arrest of cancer. Across the street, the Downings, they purchased a house, whereas the O'Brien family had lived in that house for at least one generation so far. The Downing family moved into that house when Janet married her husband, Paul Sr. At the time of the incident, Paul Sr. and Janet were divorced, had been divorced. I know Paul was remarried at that point and lived in another town. Janet lived there with, Janet had four children. The oldest was Carrie Ann, and then Aaron, and then the twin boys, Ryan and Paul Jr., were 16 years old at the time. And in the house, the only child that was not in the home at the time, living in the home, was Carrie Ann.
Now, to round out this
their
neighborhood
family
before
was,
we talk.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
To
I
round
was
this
say
out,
that,
to...
I'll wait for your question.
To round this out, you mentioned that Janet rented the other part of the duplex that she lived in to Barry and Virginia Reckley. And you also talk about, again, a very crucial person and character in this story is Gina Mahoney. So let's talk about Virginia and Barry Reckley, and then we'll talk about Gina Mahoney to round out this very, very important neighborhood in this story.
Okay. I was going to say earlier that Paul Downing Sr. and Janet Downing were not from Somerville. They were not originally from Somerville or from that neighborhood, unlike Gina Mahoney, who is the third, has the three generations of Mahoneys have grown up in her house. She lives two doors down on the O'Brien's side of the house. The Reckleys were renters. I don't believe they were from Somerville, but they were renters there for about 5 years since they had a daughter who was married who had not been married when they first moved there. They were only renters there for about 5 years.
Now, you talk about Gina Mahoney, and you talk about how close Janet was. And so tell us about where Janet was that day. That we're talking about July 23rd, 1995. So you talk about the time Janet spent with Gina. Tell us about what Gina recalls from that afternoon, that many hours that they spent together. What did they talk about? And tell us a little bit about Gina Mahoney.
Gina Mahoney is a wonderful, wonderful person. She's an icon in the neighborhood. Everyone knows her. She's been there forever. She grew up there as a child. She's known Ed Sr. since Ed Sr. was smaller. There's at least 10 or 15 years difference between the Gina Mahoney and the O'Brien parents. And she, as I said, she lives two doors down from the O'Briens, and she is just a friend to everybody in the neighborhood. Janet came over to her house very early that morning. It was a hot, hot, muggy day, and it had been a hot week. Air conditioning was not prevalent in the neighborhood. These are old three-decker houses and wooden framed houses, and people may have an air conditioning unit in their bedroom, but there was no such thing as central air. And Janet came over on that hot morning and brought her coffee, and she wanted to talk to Gina, because Gina had worked in a union office for a utility company all of her life and knew a lot about labor relations and about unions and about employee rights. And Janet was concerned because she felt she was being pushed out of her job at a local health insurance facility where she was a clerical worker. And she wanted Gina to review her performance reviews and to give her an opinion as to whether or not she should try to fight the potential discharge that she thought was coming. And that's what her initial purpose was when she came over. During the day, Gina's daughter, Danny, came in, and there was some discussion about her going out that night. And Janet immediately remarked, you know, that she should be careful where she goes at night, because 3 months before this, a young girl named Deanna Cremins had been brutally murdered just blocks from where this house is. And they still have not charged anybody with that murder, or they don't know who killed Deanna Cremins. She's been dead now almost 23 years. So that was much on everybody's mind. And after Danny left the room, Gina explained to Janet Downing that Danny was friends with Deanna Cremins, and that was upsetting, you know, and she was still very upset about that. And at which point Janet said, "If anything like that ever happens to me, I want you to promise me, Gina, that you will investigate, investigate, investigate." And she pounded her fist into the palm of her other hand and saying, "Investigate, investigate, investigate. And I would never kill myself. And even if it looks like an accident, promise me that you'll have the police investigate." And Gina was taken aback, and she said, "My God, are you afraid of something? Is something happening? And why would you even say that?" And she then explained that she was afraid of someone, and she explained why she was afraid of this person. And this person happened to be a family member of hers who she felt was following her and was trying to terrorize her. And she believed that he had been coming in and out of her house while she was at work and moving things around taking her personal diary from the nightstand. And in another harrowing incident, which had happened maybe several weeks before that, when she was coming home from work, the family member who she was afraid of worked for a cab company, and she was coming down a one-way street, and suddenly she was surrounded by these cabs, and there was one on either side of her, one in front of her, one behind her, flashing in their bright lights. It was dark out, honking their horns and penning her in. And she said she was so scared, all she could do was look straight ahead and try not to hit one of the cabs. And it was this family member's cab company. And she was absolutely unhinged by that incident. And it really, really terrified her. And as I said, another incident, she found a personal diary missing from her night table. She couldn't figure out what had happened to it. And she actually went over to her house to get it, to bring it to Gina's, to show her. And then she said that several weeks after the diary went missing, this family member, her brother-in-law, she was getting in her car again from work, and he was standing beside her car. And she looked up and she was startled. And he had the diary in his hand, and he handed it to her, and he said he had found it on the street somewhere. You know, that was absolutely not plausible. That scared her. And then she said to Gina, "Hey, do you notice? Do you ever notice cabs here at my house when I'm not home?" And Gina said, "There's a cab every day in your driveway. He's here all the time." Gina knew this brother-in-law because the brother-in-law had lived with Janet and her family for a year when they became homeless. They moved into Janet's den, and her sister and her brother-in-law and their baby moved into the den and lived with them for a year. And it was in March of 1995 that Janet had to ask them to leave the house because, according to Janet, the brother-in-law was dealing drugs to the neighborhood children from her basement, and she would not tolerate that. And he was very angry at being asked to leave, and she had asked him many times to get her keys back, and he said he didn't have them, that he lost them. But apparently it would appear that he still had them because he was in her house every day when the children were at school and she was gone. Gina saw him there. So that is a lot of what they talked about.
Right. Now, with this as well, they also talked about Carrie Ann being a problem because
she'd had struggles as a teenager. She struggled with, dabbling in drugs. She had some, issues of anger and rage and various situations that had caused disruption in the family and caused Janet to have to call the police several times and go looking for her several times when she'd run away. And I believe she was a truant at one point, or, there had been a difficulty in that situation. So Carrie Ann, at the time of her mother's murder, was living in a women's shelter with her baby.
Now, you talk about Virginia and Barry, and they had been next door for 5 years, and that day, July 23rd, 1995, they were home. Virginia and her daughter, Christine,
yes,
heard a loud boom at 8:15, and they noted that was the time, sounding like, Nick, you write, that someone was falling down or had fallen four or five steps downstairs. Now, apparently the daughter was alarmed. They didn't hear Janet's typical barking dog. So what was their reaction other than noting that they heard something? What did they do? And tell us what happens, what they soon see. Ed O'Brien, Trisha's husband, tell us what happens after they notice and shortly after what happens involving the senior, Ed O'Brien.
Okay, the Recklers were home all day babysitting for their granddaughter, Christina's daughter. And they had dinner, came at 6 o'clock. They had dinner together. It was Barry's birthday. They brought the, after dinner, they had spaghetti and meatballs. After dinner, they brought the baby out to the backyard to give the baby a pool, in a little wading pool to cool her down. They played out there for a while. And when they came, they were going back in the house to have birthday cake. And both Christina, there was a clock right over the cellar stairway as you walk in the back door. It was right there. Both of them noted that it was about 8:15 when they walked in the house. They went to the dining room to change the baby. The mother, Christina and Virginia Reckley, and the baby went to the dining room. And the dining room wall is the wall that is the party wall to the Downing home. While they were changing the baby, they heard what sounded like somebody crashing down the stairs or falling down the stairs at Janet Downing's home. And Christina was so alarmed, she said, "Oh my God, did you hear that? Should we do something?" And they stopped for a minute to listen. And Virginia said, "You know, their dog barks at everything and he's not barking. So I think it's probably okay. Or the dog would be barking." So the fact that the dog wasn't barking gave them some reassurance that everything was okay, that it wasn't anything untoward. But they were very clear, and they both were very clear about what time this happened. And they had the birthday cake, they had the celebration, and they packed up the baby. And Christina, her husband, and the baby left at about 9 o'clock. And Virginia went in to do the dishes. They had heard nothing after that bang. And she noticed when she turned on the water to do the dishes at 9 o'clock that there was no water pressure. This was a constant problem that they had in the house, and they'd had for 5 years. When anybody was using the water on the Downing side of the house, there was no pressure on the Reckley side of the house. So she said it took, 5 minutes to fill up the spaghetti pot with sudsy water to let it soak and then do all the dishes and the cake dishes and all of that stuff. She said it took a long time for her to finish the dishes. It was 9:30 or after 9:30 by the time she finished the dishes. And the entire time there was no water pressure in her house. She went into the living room. She was sitting on the couch. Barry was watching television, and she was there for, she doesn't know how long. She said sometime, a short time after she finished the dishes and went into the living room, she saw and heard Big Ed O'Brien, as he's known in the neighborhood, run by their front window and say, "Barry, come and help me. There's something wrong." And they both rushed out of the house and followed him into the Downing house. And when they got inside the Downing house, they saw Janet lying in a pool of blood in her dining room, and she appeared to be deceased. And at that moment, Ryan, who was Eddie's best friend and one of the twin sons, started to come into the house in his rollerblades, and Virginia was in her bare feet. She stepped on it. What was a picture frame that had fallen in the struggle that Janet had had. And she hoped she hadn't cut her foot or broken the glass, but she knew she had to get Ryan out of that house. And so she took him outside, and Ed called the police.
Now, you talk about
terrible scene.
Yes. You talk about that Virginia and Barry were never interviewed by Somerville police immediately after, or state police, till two weeks before they were going to testify. So,
right
now, tell us how police proceed here with what they do find and what they do conclude. Tell us who is involved and what they conclude from the evidence there. When do they talk to Eddie O'Brien, and tell us how long it takes for that arrest?
Okay. The police arrive, and there were approximately 17 people, including police, civilians, detectives, EMTs, in and out of that house before they secured the perimeter so it wouldn't be contaminated by everybody walking around in this blood. And so, in other words, I'm saying that the scene was terribly contaminated by the failure of the police to secure the scene. The police officer who was there would not let the EMTs in in the beginning, because he determined by his own calculation, by going over to the body and feeling for a pulse in her neck, that she was deceased. She was cold to the touch. That's what he said. And that there was no hope of reviving her, so that he would try to preserve the scene. At some point, he changed his mind and he let them in. So the EMTs came in, three or four of them, and they cut her clothes off, and they intubated her. They did CPR on her, and finally they put her on a stretcher to carry her out of the house. And she was there was so much blood that it was dripping down off of the stretcher, and they had to stop at some point and secure the stretcher so that they wouldn't just have a trail of blood wherever they were going. She was stabbed 98 times.
Now, you talk about he stabbed 98 times, but there's more. He removed her bra. Perpetrator removed her bra, sliced that bra 36 times, and placed it back on her body. And he also supposedly spent some time inflicting 22 other slice wounds, some as deep as 4 inches, on her neck.
The incised wounds are not superficial. They break the skin, but they're not deep wounds. They're not 4 inches long, 4 inches deep. They're ear to ear across her neck. 22 incised wounds like that. There were stab wounds to the middle of her chest, but not on her breasts. However, the bra that she was wearing had 36 stab wounds in the cups of the bra that didn't correspond to any stab wounds on her body. So they concluded that the perpetrator had, she was terribly bruised. Her ear was bruised. Her chin was bruised. She was beaten, and there was blood up and down the stairs, the last 4 or 5 stairs, on the wall, on the baseboard, on the stairs, in the entrance to the dining room, and then a huge amount of blood in the dining room. They determined that she had been she had struggled, and that she had tried to find her way into the dining room. They believe that she tried to turn the light on or off. It's unclear which way it was when she was found, and they found her. And they determined that the perpetrator had at this time undressed her, stabbed the bra, and then replaced the bra back on her, because the bra was on her, but it was not hooked in the back.
Okay, now, so we have the police trying to examine this, but meanwhile, you have information later, and as you put in the book, her neighbor, Gina Lamhoney, who had spent 10 hours with Janet, was watching the action unfolding from her porch, and she thought at first it was maybe another incident with Carrie Ann. However, she saw Artie Ortiz, her brother-in-law,
that's the brother-in-law,
walk from the Hamlet Street towards her house. So describe what she saw, what was his description, which seemed out of whack out of the norm for the considering the temperature. So tell us what she saw and what she thought at that time.
Well, Gina went over to the house. Gina went over to the Downing house. She went inside, so she was one of the other people inside. Nobody had protective booties. Nobody had medical gloves. There was medical debris all over the place that had been thrown about. But they were still working on Janet when Gina went in there. Gina said, she said, there's too many people here, and, I'm going to leave this scene and go back to my porch. And just as she was on her porch, she saw Artie Ortiz, who is Janet's brother-in-law, who used to live with her, walking up from the direction of Janet's backyard, past his cab, and his cab was penned in by the ambulances and first responders, the fire trucks, and police cars, so that he had been parked there, obviously, before they got there, and they got there at about 2 minutes after 10, and she saw him. He walked over to her house, and she said it was the hottest, muggiest night, and he looked like he had just stepped out of a shower, and he was, you know, very well-groomed, and he claimed that he'd been driving cab, and he claimed that his dispatcher called him and told him that his sister-in-law had been murdered. And this is seconds after Janet was still in the house. Her body was still in the house, and they were still working on her. So she had by no means been dead. And that seemed very odd to Gina that he should do that. Then he asked to borrow her phone, and he borrowed the phone. And he said that he had called. I can't remember quite who he said he had called, but I think his words were, well, she's officially dead now. But she hadn't even been transported to Mass General, which is where she was declared dead. So it was very, very, very odd, his behavior and his comments about the state that Janet was in, and the fact that his car was parked there before the first responders. So it appeared from what Gina could see that he had been there and had been at the scene long before anybody was called.
You also write that he sprinted across the lawn and was stopped by an officer. He told the cop that he lost his keys and wanted to go to the backyard to look for them. He told Gina the same and said, essentially, I'm screwed. You know, he was in a panic over the lost keys that he said were in the backyard.
He said he'd lost his keys in the backyard, and the police at this point had put the yellow tape around the house and the backyard because the escape route of the perpetrator was through the backyard, through the back door. And that's what's assumed anyway. There was blood all over the back door. So the cellar door was wide open. They wouldn't let him go back and get his keys. And he had to call a tow truck to come and get the cab. Gina didn't know that the back door was open at that point or what role that had played in the whole scenario. And she tried to calm him down and said, you know, don't worry. I'm sure this happens to cab drivers all the time. And just call them. They must have an extra set of keys at the office. And he said, no, you don't understand. You don't understand. This is really bad. And she said, well, and then apparently he called a tow truck and the tow truck came and got the cab. And I don't know factually whatever happened about his keys. I have been told that they were retrieved by the police and returned to him. But I don't know that for a fact.
You talk about Gina, and of course Gina is a friend of Janet and the family and a neighborhood fixture. And so investigators ask her a couple of questions. When was the last time you saw Janet Downing, and when did she leave your house? So then Gina
says...
That was
the following day.
She made it clear
that
she had additional information. So tell us about what she wanted to tell them and this transaction where she couldn't get that information to these police and why.
She wanted to tell them about Janet's fear of her brother-in-law and her brother-in-law's behavior the night before and his appearance the night before while Janet was being worked on by the EMTs and what he had done at her house and what he had said at her house and also what Janet was afraid of and that how she expressed that fear literally hours, 2 hours before she was murdered. And they said they didn't need to know any of that. That's all they needed to know right now was they didn't need to know anything else. They needed to know what time Janet had left her house and was that the last time she saw her. And that was it. She said, I have a lot of information. about this. She was with me all day, and they said, no, we're all set. That's all we need to know right now. And then for a year, Gina called the Detective Bureau to try to get them to interview her and to tell them that she had information she thought was relevant. And they just said, we have all the information we need. Thank you.
Now you take us back in the book to where Eddie tells his dad he's going to the Burger King, and then he goes to his friend's house, which is next door, Ryan Downing, and raps on Ryan Downing's window like he had done many a time. So what does he hear, and what does he do as a result of what he hears when he bangs on that window next door?
He heard what he thought was somebody saying, help me. And it was very dim, and the front door was wide open, and he walked into the little foyer, and then he opened the door that opened into the house itself, and he looked, and he saw the blood. And straight ahead in front of him, he saw the bathroom door open, the sink running at full force, and he turned to his right. He saw Janet lying on the floor, and he thought maybe she had fallen or fainted. He didn't know. She was on her side, and he didn't know. He didn't know what had happened to her. So he went over to her and he knelt down and he shook her and he said, Janet, are you okay? Are you okay? And she didn't respond, and she felt funny, and he turned her over, and that's when he saw all the stab wounds in her chest, and he realized that she was terribly, terribly not, you know, injured, and not by simply falling down. He then stood up and turned to go back out the front door, and he didn't know where this person came from. It seemed like he had come from behind the front door, he said, but a person who had a nylon stocking over his head confronted him with a huge knife and told him to close the inner door that he had come through, the inner foyer door. And Eddie backed himself up to that door and closed it with his hand. And the guy held the knife to his neck, and he said, you know, if you tell anybody what you've seen, I know where you live, and I know, and I'll kill your whole family. At that point, they both, the perpetrator and Eddie, heard the knock at the door of the three friends who had shown up at 9:20. And after the three boys stopped knocking, he told Eddie to get out of there and, just get out of here and don't say anything. And if you say anything, I know where you live. I'm going to kill your whole family. So Eddie took off. He ran through the kitchen, down the cellar stairs, and ran straight out the back cellar door, which was wide open. It was already wide open. And he ran through there in back. He didn't want to go turn right and go onto Hamlet Street because he was afraid the perpetrator might have gone out the front door and be running down Hamlet Street, and he would get him and kill him. So he ran into the bushes and that were behind Janet's house. And that's when the three boys who had been knocking at the front door moved, the three friends of Eddie's and Ryan, moved toward the backyard and heard the rustling of Eddie in the bushes. And Eddie jumped out of the bushes and ran down Hamlet Street. And that was at 9:20, as I said. So Eddie had left his house telling his father that he was going to Burger King, and he decided he would stop to see if Ryan was home yet. Ryan had gone swimming, and he knocked on the window, encountered that scene that I just described, and that was at 9:15. He left his house at 9:15, and at 9:20, the boys knocked on the door, and that's why the guy told him to get out. And so for Eddie to have committed, this is why it's ludicrous to think that Eddie could have committed, one of the reasons why it's ludicrous, because Eddie would have had 5 minutes to walk across. This is 25 yards away. And Eddie's father's on the front porch. Most of the neighbors are on their front porch. The whole neighborhood is out to walk across the 25 yards, 52 feet, I think it is, across the street, murder his neighbor in 5 minutes, not get a drop of blood on him, and flee out the back door all within 5 minutes it makes absolutely no sense.
But not helping him is one of the most profoundly unbelievable stories I've ever heard. He then encounters at the Burger King two teenagers confronting him, demanding his money, $17, flashing a knife, saying,
right,
"Now I have to cut you because I saw your face." And he sidesteps,
right,
but he gets his hand cut. You know, so
that's where he got his hand cut, yes.
Wow.
He was in a complete state of shock, you know. He went to the Burger King. He didn't order food. He went to the bathroom, and he just sat there trying to compose himself. I mean, he was completely in a fugue, and he doesn't remember his hand being cut then, and he finally, after he composes himself, he leaves Burger King and he starts walking down Somerville Avenue toward the convenience store, which is where he worked, and it was on that little walk that he gets confronted by two teenagers who say, "Give me all your money." He gave them $17, and one of the guys says, "Well, I think you looked at my face, now I'm going to have to cut you," and sort of lunged at him with the knife, and he grabbed the knife, and he thinks that's where he got cut, but he doesn't remember feeling that he got cut anywhere. I mean, he doesn't remember getting hurt in the bushes, which he did. He was not in a complete state of shock the entire time.
You also say to
unbelievable. Like, how many 15-year-old boys see their best friend's mother murdered and within another half an hour get mugged? I mean, the chances are a gazillion to one. And as an attorney, it's like you cringe when you hear that because you think, I will never get a jury to believe that, you know? And sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, and it's very, very hard to deal with. And no one ever believed the mugging story. That's how Eddie became a suspect. You asked me, what evidence did they have? They had no evidence whatsoever. The only evidence they had was that after Eddie got mugged, he walked into the store where he worked, and they called the police to report the mugging, handed Eddie the phone, so that this is at about 10 o'clock that he was mugged. So that's exactly when the first responders are getting to Janet Downing's house and finding her murdered. So they catching these calls, they learn through their radios that Eddie has a cut on his hand at midnight convenient, and Janet Downing is stabbed. Therefore, we should look at Eddie. That is basically what happened. Because when the police came and looked at the EMTs came, they looked at Eddie's hand. They said there was no blood. He wasn't bleeding. He didn't have any blood on his hands. You know, they said, you know, we think you're okay. Just go home. Then the police drove him home. And it was his grandfather who said, no, you need to go to the hospital and you need to get a tetanus shot, if nothing else. And so his family drove him up to the hospital. And it was then that the Somerville police dispatched somebody from the district attorney's office and somebody from Somerville up to the hospital where Eddie was being seen for the cut on his hand. And swabbed the blood on his legs.
We're going to use this as an opportunity to take a break to talk about today's sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire them. Hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners of True Murder can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When we last left off, Margot, we were talking about some of the circumstances that Eddie O'Brien came to be the number one suspect. Let's talk about what happens to Eddie O'Brien immediately after, and you can start introducing some of the legal people that are responsible for Eddie O'Brien being arrested shortly after this little bit of information comes to light for those people.
The only information they had was that Eddie had a cut and Janet Downing was stabbed. That's really the only information they had for 2 days. But that night, the night of the murder, and the night that he was at the hospital, they brought Eddie down to the police station. They took his clothes, the clothes he had on. They took his fingerprints. They asked him if he had been at Janet Downing's house. He had left earlier in the day when all the boys were there hanging out, and he said he had not returned. He was not going to tell the police anything because he was terrified that his family was in jeopardy. His mother had just had a baby. His grandfather was dying. Family would have to leave the residence. So he did not tell the truth to the police. It was sometime later that they swabbed the blood on his legs, and they allege, I don't know, because we haven't tested it too, but they allege that one of those, one drop of blood on his shin tested as an AB type blood, and his blood was O, and Janet Downing's was AB. Now, they never did DNA on it. We never determined if it was Janet Downing's blood or not, but they determined that because that blood was a match, and his fingerprints were found in Janet Downing's blood on the back of that door when he closed the door, that he not only was he the prime suspect, he was the one and only suspect. From the minute he called in to the police from Midnight Convenient until he was tried and convicted 2 years later, they never, ever looked at another suspect.
At the same time, Ortiz and his wife, Carol, they said that there was something about the wishes of Janet, that they wanted, that Janet would want them to have her car and to continue taking care of their home and raise their children even. So with that audacious claim to try to get their stuff, still never raised any red flags with anybody in law enforcement, did it?
Law enforcement didn't know about it because they told that to Gina Mahoney. The next day, the day after Janet's murder, Artie came by and said, listen, Janet told me, we had a long talk, and she told me if anything ever happened to her that she wanted me to have her car. And, you know, Gina thought, this guy is delusional. She was terrified of you. She would never have done that. And that she even wanted us to move back into the house and take care of her children. And that was all the information that Gina had that the police said they didn't need.
Right. Now, also what happens is that in short order, Again, Eddie's cooperating, and his father's cooperating, and he submits to the sodium amytal, so the truth serum. And what's the results of that? Even though it's not admissible, what's the results from that?
The results of that were that he told the exact same story before he was administered any truth serum and after he was administered truth serum. And the results by the PhD psychologist who administered the test said that he was being truthful and that he had not committed this crime.
Now, they realize that there's nothing, there's the person, the keys were on the kitchen counter, there's no robbery.
Right.
What is their initial idea? Because quickly they have some kind of idea that what this crime was all about. And, of course, that changes.
But what
is it initially they think that there could be a motive or reason for
initially,
this person
initially they stated,
committing this murder?
Initially, District Attorney Tom Riley, who personally oversaw the investigation and personally litigated the case, he was the elected district attorney for the county of Middlesex. He said, we have no idea as to motive. It's going to take us a while to figure out motive. And that was there was no suggestion of motive, really. There was a complete everybody was perplexed, including the investigators, as to motive, until the psychologist who evaluated Eddie in the juvenile facility for the court. The court ordered a psychological evaluation. Until the psychologist submitted his report in December and said, you know, what's striking is the absence of motive. And once that report was submitted and the district attorney realized what trouble he was in, even though he doesn't have to prove motive, immediately came up with theories of a motive. And his theory started with that Eddie had an unusual interest in Janet Downing, that he was more curious about her than he should have been. And then it evolved into that this interest had a sexual overtone to it. And, you know, by the middle of the transfer hearings and the course that this case took in the juvenile court, you know, he was a full-blown sexual predator, essentially, is what they were trying to say. And that, of course, never held water with anybody and was not ever presented at his adult trial because it was just not provable. By the time they got to the adult court and did the adult trial, they went back to he had an unusual interest in her.
Now
that was what they said the motive was.
The biggest issue of this, and the reason why you call it politics of murder, is that there are some changes in juvenile law, incredible changes. So I'm going to get you to tell
incredible,
us what was before, what was juvenile law and the split sentencing, and then talk about why there were changes in the juvenile law and why at this time and why Riley, and tell us about the politics of murder.
There's a lot of talk at the time and about the super predators, about running our inner cities, running, you know, crazy through our inner cities and killing innocent people. And we have to tighten and toughen the juvenile laws. And the governor at the time, Governor Bill Weld, was very much in favor of that, as was Attorney General Riley. District Attorney Riley. And at the same time, Governor Weld was seeking to run for a Senate seat, and Mr. Riley was seeking to run for the Attorney General's office in preparation for eventually running for governor. And this was a perfect storm, a perfect cause to come to the people with, that, you know, we're going to get tough on juvenile crime, and we support these laws. So that the law used to be that if you were under the age of 16, that the government had to, if you were between the ages of 14 and 16, you could not be charged with murder in adult court. If you were 16 and above, you could the government could come in and prove that you were not a good candidate for rehabilitation and ask that you be transferred to adult court. While Eddie was in the system, those laws changed, and they changed as a direct result of this case and some others that had occurred in downtown Boston. And so that eventually what we ended up was with a law that juveniles as young as 14 can be tried in adult court, and that it was their obligation to prove to a juvenile judge if they were between 14 and 16, it was the juvenile's obligation to prove that he could be rehabilitated. So you can see what the conundrum was for Eddie O'Brien. He had to prove that he could be rehabilitated from a murder he didn't commit. Plus, they were creating a whole new juvenile court system. And so the courts were in flux. And then there was split sentencing where they could sentence you and you'd do part of your time as a juvenile, part of your time as an adult. And Eddie was one of the first people to be subjected to that law. And the governor was vocal in his support of that law as Eddie's case was pending and referring to the case. And the governor was appointing judges to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts who would rule on that case. And he was appearing in rallies with the Downing family standing beside him. And it was pretty spectacular.
Now, you talk about, we won't be able to cover everything, but you talk about some really glaring non-evidence here in that he claims to have worn some clothes and he's in the same clothes. So you give us the three or four points that you have that seem to be incredulous that Riley, despite his political aspirations, should still be an acting district attorney with some kind of moral, you know, ethical boundaries. And so what is he ignoring in your view that's so glaring in terms of evidence?
There are a couple of things that he's ignoring. One is that for Eddie to have changed his clothes, they seized his clothes, the clothes he had on that night. They seized them. They were the same clothes he had been wearing all day. No blood on them. And white t-shirt with no blood, sneakers with no blood. And they say, well, you know, that's easy. He must have changed his clothes. And so how did he change his clothes and into what and when and where? He would have had to change his clothes, hide his old sweaty clothes. And then, you know, the people that committed this crime, if it was more than one person, were covered in blood, head to toe, in their hair, under their fingernails, on their eyelashes. They would take more than a shower to get the blood off of you. So he's claiming that he walked out of this scene covered in blood, somehow put on his old clothes without getting any blood on them and without having the opportunity to shower. And it was just ludicrous. Ludicrous. So, and the timeline, you know, I mean, how he's ignoring the timeline. He's ignoring the fact that there's no suggestion that he ever changed clothes. People saw him at 9:15 in these clothes. They saw him at 10 o'clock in these clothes. And there was no change of clothes. And they're also ignoring the fact that he didn't have time to do any of the things that needed to be done in order to change his clothes and murder somebody and then come out without any blood, not only on his clothes, but on him anywhere, at least around his cuticles, under his fingernails, nothing.
Let's talk about the murder weapon and the conclusiveness of that in terms of being the smoking gun here. How strong or weak is the murder weapon evidence?
Well, the Commonwealth, the district attorney alleged that, or this theory was that Eddie had committed this murder with a 3-inch pocket penknife, and meaning the blade was 3 inches long, and then the handle was another 2.5 inches, let's say. It was a very small decorative knife. And they made that allegation because they found a piece of metal, which they said would have been the hilt to that knife that Eddie had shown other people at some time previous to this. The wounds that Janet Downing suffered, some of them were up to 4 inches deep, which would have meant that, and the knife Eddie had 2 hilts, not just one. They found 1 hilt. So that the perpetrator, if he used Eddie's knife, or if Eddie were the perpetrator and used the knife, he would have had to have Downing with a 3-inch knife and gone 1 inch into the handle with one of the hilts still on it. And there was no evidence of any markings of that kind, no bruising around any of the stab wounds that she had. And some of them were 4 inches deep. One wound went through her chest, severed 2 ribs, and punctured her lung and went into her liver, I believe. That's how deep it was. You just can't do that with a 3-inch blade. It was 5/8 of an inch wide, and some of the wounds were twice that wide. So it didn't make any sense that would be the murder weapon, but that's what he went with, and he got his conviction with that.
Before we get to any kind of conviction, we've got to talk about the steps
DNA
along the way and the brave people that came and gave you interviews and gave you the information to be able to do this incredible expose, as we talked about. You interviewed Richard Barnum. You did interviews with family. You got grand jury minutes. But more importantly, you interviewed Judge Paul Hefferman, the presiding judge in these transfer cases. So the transfer is to see if he's going to be raised to adult court. Judge Paul Hefferman as the judge. How does it proceed with Judge Paul Hefferman? Before we talk about
Hefferman,
jump ahead and tell us what he said at the time, what he was asked to do at the time.
Judge Hefferman heard the transfer hearing, and he weighed all the evidence, and he determined that even if Eddie had committed this crime, that he certainly was a candidate for rehabilitation and had no history of mental illness and was found to have no mental illness and no need for any mental health care by the psychologist appointed by the court, psychiatrist appointed by the court. Judge Hefferman determined that he should remain in the juvenile system, where if found guilty, he would have done time in juvenile detention until his 21st birthday, at which point he would have been transferred to an adult jail or prison for another 15 years after that. In other words, even if he had been found guilty as a juvenile and Judge Hefferman had not been removed from the case, he would be out of jail by now. He'd be free. Judge Hefferman, however, a week after he made his decision, he was called by a fellow judge who told him that the judges above them had made it clear that unless he changed his opinion, he would be removed from the case. Judge Hefferman, and thank God for Judge Hefferman, because he's the only one who tried to stop this train wreck. Judge Heffernan's response was, "I would rather walk naked through Sullivan Station than change my opinion. Let them do what they have to do." And he just sat back, and so the district attorney appealed the Heffernan decision and asked that Heffernan be removed. The Supreme Court sent it back to Judge Heffernan to consider additional evidence. Judge Hefferman, the district attorney, presented a motion for recusal asking Judge Hefferman to step down. Judge Hefferman denied that. He refused to step down. And he said they would proceed with taking new evidence. as ordered by the Supreme Court, and at which point the district attorney appealed the judge's denial of his motion up to the Supreme Court, who had already considered, he had asked already to have Judge Heffernan removed, and the Supreme Court declined to do that, although he had been told that he was going to be removed. And so after the second appeal, and Judge Heffernan refused to voluntarily recuse himself, the Supreme Court ordered him off the case.
You talk about the political aspirations when you talk about Judge Heffernan. In his friend and longtime colleague, Judge Zoll, had spoken to him, and a week later called him again and said, listen, we need you to change this. They want you to change this decision.
Right.
Yet they still remain friends, but it demonstrates and illustrates how important this was for the political aspirations of Riley, the DA, and the governor, other aspirations as well. You talk
Judge
about
Zoll
and make some claims.
I just want to make a claim
of manipulation.
Judge Zoll was not the person who was asking or suggesting that Heffernan should change his decision. He was Judge Zoll's immediate supervisor. He was Judge Heffernan's immediate supervisor. He was the one who got the call from up above saying, have him change his opinion. And he told, they were friends. He said, I'm not going to change my opinion. Judge Zoll, I think, applauded him for standing his ground and saying, I'm not going to do what they want done politically because it's wrong legally.
Yes.
So Judge Zoll is a good guy, is what I wanted to say.
Right. Now, you also talk about, again, manipulation is what the word you use. So this is a strong word, manipulation, impropriety, some of these things that any other way of calling a travesty of justice, and also with this Dr. Richard Barnum, and something very interesting, legally making a 41-page report assessing the whether he can be rehabilitated, Eddie O'Brien, but this addendum. And then, so explain the actual manipulation that you describe with Riley and with this Barnum and what they want to do and how they twist some information and try. They do not get it through with Heffernan, but they're still always trying to get a certain amount of information. Tell us about that manipulation and what that information is that they've tried to squeeze out of dubious sources.
That actually happened after Heffernan had made his decision. After Dr. Barnum produced his first report noting that there was an alarming absence of motive here and no mental illness, and it was a very confusing situation. DA Riley immediately met with him and told him, "Well, then you don't know about the fact that he was questioned when some of his friends put a mailbox on fire, and you don't know about all the things that we should have told you about." There was a laundry list of things that he came forward with that he had every opportunity to talk to Barnum about at any point during his three-month investigation. But only after he submitted his report did he determine that these things should be shared with Dr. Barnum. They were completely, in my opinion, this is all my opinion based on what I see as the evidence. He gave Barnum a list of things that would be troublesome. For instance, some allegations of watching women undress and being concerned about whether or not Janet Downing was having a lesbian relationship with one of her best friends, or things, you know, just things that were of absolutely no consequence or import or relationship to this case that he suddenly decided to throw in to the mix. And essentially, the district attorney Riley had Barnum go and interview all these people to give him these stories. And none of those stories were ever proven to be true. And none of them were ever raised at his actual trial because they were not based in fact. He was just basically trying to create a motive, and that's what he was trying to do. But Dr. Barnum made it clear to me that that he felt that he had felt the political pressure of the case. I mean, it was in the newspaper every day. Everybody was talking about it. There was nothing positive ever being printed about Eddie. Everything was negative. It was all coming from the quote-unquote police sources and investigative sources and things like that. Nothing was coming out of Eddie's side to say the things that I'm saying now, for instance. So the public's view, and I think I pointed this out when I showed that virtually there was only one person in a pool of 275 people who were considered for jury duty in this case that had not heard about this case. 33% of those people had already decided he was guilty and had to be excused without a piece of evidence being heard. The case against him was a foregone conclusion. It had been tried in the press by that point. I asked Barnum about that, and I asked him about why he changed his opinion, because in his addendum to his report, which was twice as long as his original report, he decided, no, Eddie O'Brien wasn't amenable to rehabilitation. And that just never sat right. I mean, that felt to me that he was capitulating to the political pressure that he was feeling. He was the director of a court clinic at that point. He was a government employee, et cetera. He said to me that, yes, he felt the political pressure. Basically, he changed his opinion because by the time we got to this point in the proceedings, Eddie was now 17 years old, not 15 when he first met him. And he would be aging out of the juvenile system at 18 now. So there was no point to talk about rehabilitation, because by the time his adult trial took place, he would be too old to be in the juvenile system. I asked him, why didn't you just say that? Why didn't you just say, you know, I don't need to write an addendum. I can just tell you that there's no system that can provide rehabilitation if he needs rehabilitation in the time that he has left in the juvenile system. And he said, that's a very good point. Maybe that's what I should have said. Because essentially it raised the whole course of the case. Because once he wrote that addendum, Heffernan refused to accept that addendum into evidence. And that's what started the appeal process. And that's what the Supreme Court remanded the case for, to say that Judge Heffernan should consider Barnum's addendum. That's why it got sent back. And I believe that the judges in authority were hoping that Heffernan would quietly step away voluntarily. And he was not going to do that. He was not going to betray his moral stance that he had made the right decision, and I'm not going to capitulate to political power.
Now, you talk about DNA in 1996 being in its infancy in comparison to now and mm-hmm. developments in the turn of the century. What was the forensic evidence other than what could be explained away by Eddie O'Brien's story of touching her and touching this and touching that. You talk about DNA under Janet's fingernails. Tell us about all the DNA. This is the evidence is very strong. Tell us what the DNA evidence was, the forensic evidence was.
The DNA forensic evidence for Eddie's DNA was completely consistent with his story, that his DNA was found on those fingerprints and completely consistent with the story he told right after the crime, when it was 2 weeks later that he told what really happened. And he admitted that he had seen this guy and that he had run from the scene. He stayed in jail. He didn't even tell his parents because he was so afraid for their safety. And it finally, after 2 weeks, he told them. And he said, listen, I did go in there. But anyway, that all of the DNA that was found that was attributable to Eddie was consistent with his story, completely consistent with his story. The DNA under Janet's fingernails, Eddie is excluded as the primary source of that DNA. There's a DNA of Janet and another DNA, unidentified DNA. On the alleged murder weapon, the alleged hilt of the knife that they found, the metal piece, Eddie was completely excluded from as a contributor to DNA on that, but there is an unidentified male DNA on that hilt and Janet Downing's DNA. So he is not tied to the murder weapon by DNA. He is not tied to under Janet's fingernails, which is the first, you know, source of DNA that they look for because that's what she fought for her life with. They didn't even test the DNA under her fingernails until right before the adult trial. I don't know why. My opinion, again, is they didn't do it because they knew it would not be Eddie's. And they wanted to wait until the last possible moment before they revealed that DNA was not hers. And their expert witness testified that it basically, in her opinion, the DNA was inconclusive, which is not allowed into evidence. If it's inconclusive, it's not allowed into evidence. So it never should have gone in if it was inconclusive. There's definitely identifiable DNA that is not Eddie's on the murder weapon.
Now, you mentioned Gina and her finally getting to speak, and Vicky and Barry. But despite all of this, what's the conclusion in adult court before we talk about your interviews with Eddie, your continuing correspondence with him? Tell us a little bit about what's the result of this trial despite what you just mentioned. What happened?
The DNA evidence just never came into evidence that way. It was, first of all, there was a big failure of his defense counsel at trial. He never had any of these exhibits or pieces of evidence tested independently. And so he too could have had the DNA under Janet's fingernails tested, but did not. So there is some blame to go around. What happened at trial was that the evidence did not come in that clearly, so that the DNA evidence, as I said, the jurors were overwhelmed with it, and it was very confusing. His own attorney did not capitalize on the fact that Eddie's DNA was absent from the two most important places that it should have been found, either in his opening or his closing statement. He alluded to it in his cross-examination, but frankly, it appeared to me that he didn't understand that Eddie's DNA was excluded from this. He got the reports very late, and I don't think he was completely familiar with them or what they meant. He didn't have his own expert to sit and explain them to him. The only real thing that came out at trial was that there was, on the hilt of the knife, the DNA was identifiable and it was not Eddie's. As to Janet's fingernails, that was never really an issue at trial. It just slipped by and slipped in as inconclusive. But in fact, the report is clear that he is excluded. It's not inconclusive. And I didn't have the report at the time. I didn't know that. I didn't know that until I read it this year when I was writing the book. His parents didn't know that until I read it this year when I was writing the book. Many of these things were complete revelations to me. And I had been with the case since the very beginning. I did not understand that. I had no access to the reports. I wasn't given the reports or the evidence. And I trusted that his attorney was doing what he needed to do and was presenting whatever evidence in Eddie's favor there was. But in fact, there was a lot of evidence in Eddie's favor, including the fact that there was communication between the district attorney's office and the laboratory where they did a preliminary DNA test on the hilt of the knife a year before Eddie's trial, determined Eddie's DNA was not on it, and he stopped all further testing until further notice, but didn't tell the defense that they had done a preliminary test. And then they told the trial judge that they had just sent that hilt out for testing a couple of weeks into July of the before his September trial, when in fact that had been sent out for testing a year before, and they knew his DNA was not on it and was not going to come up on it. So the final report issued saying his DNA was not on it, but that was news to his defense attorney. It was only me comparing the reports and the correspondence between the lab and the district attorney's office that I realized they learned that his DNA wasn't on that a year before that. And then they ordered all further testing to cease so that they didn't have to produce a report. And that would have gone into the juvenile case.
We've got just a few minutes to tell the story left in this interview. You start off as guardian ad litem, but your relationship morphs into something much more. He grows up literally, physically, and psychologically. Tell us briefly the correspondence, who he is, who he's become, and what your relationship is, and how he is dealing with life without the possibility of parole. Before we talk about the one bright spot in this story, which is the Innocence Project.
You have to meet Eddie. You have to meet him. He's a remarkable, remarkable kid. You have to understand that he's been in jail for almost 22 years, and he was only on the outside for 15 years. He was a baby when he went into prison, and he has been incarcerated every day since then. He was going into his sophomore year of high school when he was incarcerated. He missed high school. He is self-educated. He has spent his years in jail educating himself through voracious reading. He reads tons of history books. He stays current on political issues, and he's very, very opinionated about political issues and has very strong feelings about things. He's got a wonderful sense of humor. When I first met Eddie, he was a little kid. He blushed every time I talked to him. Okay. His cheeks would turn bright red. He would stare at his sneakers. He would smile. You know, he was a child. He was such a young adolescent, you know, with no experience whatsoever in the ways of the world. His neighborhood was a pretty protected little neighborhood. And, you know, he had a little group of friends that he hung with since he was a toddler, you know. His life was completely different. He was incarcerated with violent juveniles who had murdered and who would murder again. He was with kids who had mental health problems, learning disabilities, all kinds of behavioral issues. That's where he grew up. That's where he learned. And, you know, that's who he had to socialize with. And he does not call jail the real world. He knows what the real world is. The real world is his friends and his family. Outside of prison, they have stuck by him completely for the last 21 plus years. He talks to his parents every single day on the phone, I think twice a day. He speaks to his siblings every day, one or more of them. He's a godfather to his nieces and nephews, no nephews yet. The babies come to visit him. They know him as Uncle Eddie. He has just done everything he can to remain as socialized as he can with people from the outside. He deals with life the way you have to deal with it. You have to take it one day at a time. Nothing is guaranteed. And he said that was the most important lesson he learned. When he arrived in adult prison, some old timers took him under their wing and they taught him how to do time. And that's what he said to me. He said, I wouldn't have made it if they hadn't taught me how to do time. He's patient. You know, he is funny. He loves to joke around. He loves to call me out when I'm wrong. And needle me about it. He argues with me. Sometimes he gets angry with me if I don't agree with him. Sometimes he's a normal kid. He's not a kid. Now he's a man. He's 36 years old. He's got gray hair. He's not that little kid anymore. He's so wise. He's so much wiser than I was at 36. And he was so much younger at 15 than I was at 15. It's unbelievable. But he's just a wonderful guy. He proudly calls himself a Roman Catholic. He belongs to a rosary group. He goes to mass every Sunday. He's never stopped doing that. These are not things he does because he hopes to get parole someday, because he knows that's not going to happen for him. He does these things because this is what makes his life worth living.
Just to wrap up, what the Innocence Project was interested in this case, what was the status of the case for them? What is it for Eddie O'Brien? Tell us.
It's called the Innocence Program. It's a state program that is very much aligned with the national program, which is called the Innocence Project. This is called the Innocence
Right.
Program. And Eddie has a team of lawyers that he's working with, and they are actively working with him. And it certainly is a ray of hope. For years, he's had really no representation. He's never filed anything. He got a direct appeal automatically because everybody who's sentenced to life without parole gets an automatic appeal. That's the only thing he's really filed. He has many, many, many appellate, very, very strong appellate issues and that legal issues that will be brought to light, I'm sure, by his legal team, and they're working very hard at that as we speak. So it's an open case. And you know, I just can't wait until there is some more movement. And I would love to see the case, the investigation reopened, because I want to know who is it that killed Janet Downing. And I would hope that her family wants to know that. And I know that they've been convinced that Eddie must be the true murderer because he was convicted and because they were told that, but they weren't told all of the things that I discovered when I went through the entire file. And I think that Janet Downing deserves that much respect, that we would find her real killer and bring her real killer to justice. Now, that may or may not free Eddie. There are lots of stories of people confessing to murders that other people are doing time for, and the court's still not letting them out. You know, it's a very arbitrary and uphill situation trying to undo a wrongful conviction. But I have every confidence in the world that that's going to happen in this case. And I know that because I know Eddie, and I know Eddie can stick with something until the right thing happens. And I believe that this is going to happen, and I believe he is going to be returned to a normal life. And if I didn't believe that, I would have a really hard time putting my head on the pillow every night.
Now, before we let you go, this is a Wild Blue Press release, and for those that might want to contact you or see some of your other work, do you do a website? Tell us how people might contact you or see your other work.
Yes, I have a website called thepoliticsofmurder.com, thepoliticsofmurder.com, also margonash.com, and the most material that you can find, including other writings that I've done and reviews of the book, you can find at www.wildbluepress.com under the author profile.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Margot, for coming on and talking about this expose, The Politics of Murder. Fascinating story. Thank you very much, and you have a great night.
Thank you, Dan, for having me.
Thank you.